Chapter 9. Sloan kneels, blind and bound. The ratty ribbon across her eyes is filthy and rough. It feels like it's abrading the skin off her face. This whole planet is like that, though. Everything is coarse-grained sandpaper, wearing down first to muscle, then to bone, then to the marrow beneath, and soon only to whatever passes for a soul or a spirit. A ghost left to wander these dust-choked deadlands. Her wrists chafe too. The rope binding them is raw and fibrous. At least they haven't sealed her mouth or her ears. What she hears, the pad, pad, pad of feet on stone. Not hers, but those who pull the cart in which she waits, drawing it deeper and deeper through the winding red cavern. The cart itself is old, stone fiber boards lashed together with braids of tendon, and not buoyed by hover planks or grav plates, but rather kept rolling by a pair of proper wheels. Wheels that clank and rattle as the cart is drawn over the hard, rust stone. What she says,
"We're almost there. The air is colder down here."
What he says, "I hope so. Everything of mine is cramping up." Those are the words of her traveling companion, a man named Brenton Wexley. She found him stowing away in her ship when she barely managed to escape Chandrilla. Sloan was injured and drifting toward death, but he saved her life. Sometimes she's surprised he's still with her. But his purpose is her purpose, too. Find Gallius Rax and end him. Rax, who stole her empire from her. Rax, who stuck a chip in this man's head and turned him into a killer. Vengeance drives the pair of them. It marries them, too, in a way. The oddest of couples, aren't they? She, the one-time Grand Admiral of the Empire, a title she cannot imagine matters anymore. And he, a former rebel spy turned programmed Imperial assassin. Neither of them wants to be here, but this is where they are. And they've been here for months. Jakku is a decrepit wasteland, bleached to death by an unforgiving sun. And now, mysteriously, it hosts the largest remnant of the Empire. Her remnant, as a matter of fact. A military faction she thought she controlled. But her control was an illusion. She was just another puppet dancing on the strings of Gallius Rax, a supposed war hero who came to serve the Empire at the urging of Palpatine himself. None of it makes sense. Questions layer atop questions, and no answers are forthcoming. Why here? Why this place? It seems that Rax himself comes from this world. But why return? Jakku is no prize. It has few exports of note. Kesium and Bezerite have some value to the Empire, but only barely. Better resources exist, and they exist on worlds far livelier than this one. Why make an attack on Chandrilla only to abandon the galaxy and come here? Why leave Sloan dangling on the hook? Why do any of it? What is Rax's game? He has one. That much is clear. He will tell her. One day soon, she will make him tell her. At the end of a blaster, a blade, or her own choking hands. But first, they must get to him. Which is why they're here, right now, on this rolling cart. A cart pulled by men unclothed except for the skirts of threaded leather hanging from their waists. Their chests, backs, arms, and shorn scalps are naked, painted with streaks of greasy red dust. Their mouths are closed with metal hooks. A hook in the top lip, a hook in the bottom, the two tugged together with a cinching knot. They can only murmur and mumble. They are servants and slaves. ardent operators and faithful lunatics giving their lives over to their mad desert mistress. Next to her, Brenton grunts and growls as he shifts.
I told you, she says to him. Practice your breathing. Relax your limbs. A deep breath in, a deep breath out. Oxygenate your blood.
Since leaving Ganthal, Sloane has lived her life on starships. In her earliest days, she flew patrols and TIE fighters and shuttles. And her very first job was as a signal hawk on an asteroid monitoring station in the Anoat sector. Those roles did not allow her the luxury of getting up and moving around easily. And so she learned ways to remain comfortable, even in contortion.
That only helps so much, he snaps.
And she detects a surge of anger. He hates her, she believes, though he won't say as much. It stands to reason. His own wife, a rebel pilot, is the one who gave her the grievous wound he helped her to heal in the first place. She represents something he despises. The autocratic rule of a mad galaxy. He prefers that madness. The madness of rebellion. So be it. This alliance is built on anger and hatred. And that hatred is the glue that fixes Brenton to Sloane. The cart stops short. Hard enough that she almost loses her balance, which would mean pitching forward and smashing her face on the stone fiber boards. Next to her, she hears Brenton do exactly that.
He oofs as his head thuds against the floor of the cart.
Footsteps all around them. Hands grab at her face, tugging the blindfold off. Hers is stubborn and fails to easily fall away, and she feels the cold metal of a crooked blade against her temple. Thankfully, the blade faces away, and with a quick pull, the cloth is cut and falls. It takes her vision a moment to adjust. A massive impasse awaits. The cavern ends in a gargantuan, bulb-shaped chamber. Its walls shot through with other smooth-walled tunnels. Tunnels that are too high up for this cart to easily reach. Next to her, she spies Brenton. His face and neck scrubby with beard. His forehead smudged with filth. He gasps as the slaves lift him up, rocking him back on his knees. They cut his blindfold free, too. Red-streaked, dust-caked faces regard them with wide eyes. Hook-bound mouths murmur and hum. The servants perform one more action, cutting through the ropes that bind their wrists, before scampering off like animals. They clamber up the rocks, long fingernails mooring in the cracks. They pull themselves into the tunnels and scurry away. Sloane and Brenton are alone. He gives her a puzzled look.
Now what?
Those two words echo, echo, echo in the bell-shaped cavern.
I suppose we wait, she says.
They don't want us to follow, do they?
I'm strong, but not strong enough to climb up into those tunnels.
Still, maybe that's what these deviants expect.
They seem hardly human.
Sanity does not shine in their eyes.
No. What lingers there in their stares is a special kind of derangement.
The zeal of service. Of having given your body and your mind over to someone else.
Sloane does not add that climbing into those tunnels would be difficult.
Her side hurts today. A dread deep ache from her injury. An injury that never really healed properly. Sometimes she lifts her shirt just to look at it. The skin there is puckered, like the sealed, dry lips of a dead man.
Were she still in civilization, it would have healed over well with Bacta and Mend Gel treatments. But Jakku is not civilization, and so her wound healed poorly.
Every day it hurts, the pain lurking far deeper than the skin.
Brenton stands and stretches. He gingerly steps down off the cart, almost losing his footing.
Sometimes Sloane looks at him and sees how much he's been stripped down.
Again, the planet has an abrasive. He's gone from being a gangly, unruly branch to something leaner. A spear. A splinter. Though she hasn't seen a mirror in months, Sloane assumes it's happened to her, too. Times like this, she realizes nothing will ever be the same. She'll never have her empire back. She'll never have her own starship.
I'm going to die on this planet.
That truth has settled into the well of her gut. That truth is a part of her now.
I don't think...
Brenton starts to say, but the sound of something coming through those tunnels cuts him off. It's a rasping sound. Something sliding along sand-swept stone.
It's her. Their mistress.
The hut's face appears at the topmost chamber. Bruised dark with red striations, the slug's face is not fat and thick as those of many huts, but narrower, like a slimy arrowhead. The mouth is wide, practically bisecting its whole head. The maw opens, and a long, lash-like tongue licks the air, tasting it. The hut hisses. She blinks her one eye. The other is roomy, the skin around it pocked and pitted with flecks of embedded metal, like a moon with glittering debris caught in its orbit. The slug begins to slither. Up out of the chamber she comes, long arms pulling herself down from tunnel to tunnel. Sloane has met other huts. Jabba, for instance, was a fat, blubbery stump, whose short tail was the most dexterous part of his corpulent body. A worm, a slug, a grub. This hut is longer, leaner. Not like a slug at all, but like a serpent. The hut slithers and wriggles down toward the ground. Sloane sees that behind the thing's head are a series of bulbous nodules and tumor-like protuberances. They hang bound together with filthy red ribbon, a strange accessory serving as an emblem of the creature's curious vanity. As the hut nears the bottom of the hollow cavity, once more her servants emerge from the various tunnels and chambers. They meet the beast at the bottom, thrusting the palms of their hands upward, catching her as she eases forward. Their hands form her stage, their feet her vehicle. Dozens of her slaves now make up a roving dais. They hum and sing gibberish as they draw her forward. Their gibberish dissolves into a single word.
Nima! Nima!
They haul her forward, this long-tailed worm. It is Nima who will help them. It is Nima who will open the way to find Rax. On this world, Rax is a ghost. Nobody knows him. Nobody's heard of him. Sloane and Brenton went to every ramshackle shanty town they could find. From Cratertown to Blowback, to hovels in the desert. They visited with Tito's hiding in their trapdoor tunnel systems. They asked questions of Blarina traders, of Kesium gas miners, of black market merchants. Rax was a non-entity. Then, someone said something. A bartender back in Cratertown, one of the first people they'd met on this world. He said for them to be careful, that someone had been stealing children. The Empire needs children. Wasn't that what Rax told her? She asked the bartender.
Where? Why?
He said he didn't know, but they'd been taken by thugs belonging to Nima the Hutt. Most taken from small villages and from the makeshift orphanages run by the Anchorites.
That's where most of the kids are kept. Nobody wants children running underfoot when you have a heavy-gauge blast drill blowing chunks of canyon wall apart. so they dump them there. Or the anchorites and their nurse women.
The bartender added,
I would have never let my kids go there.
The thought hit her. If Rax had been a child here, what if he was there? An orphan left behind for the anchorites. That's when she found the trail. And it began with a man named Anchorite Kolob. He was a wretched old monk, carved by wind and sand, and worst of all by time. She found him kneeling in a mud daub hut with a bent metal roof. He was praying. When she demanded he help them, he did so willingly. But he also said the man she seeks is not a man named Gallius Rax. Rax is a lie. A false identity, he explained.
Gally, what's the boy?
Kolob said, his voice shaking. He said to her that Gally was always a rebellious one, always running off and chasing stories. Then one day, something truly changed in him. He became defiant. He led the other children astray. They began disappearing. And one day, Gally disappeared too.
Now the child has returned, and he is a child no longer.
The anchorite tried then to sermonize to them, some nonsense parable about seeds growing in dead ground, but she cut him off and asked,
Where did he go when he used to disappear?
The valley of the Eremite, near a rock formation called the Plaintive Hand. That was where he could be found, the stories say. He wouldn't let anyone get close. He had traps. He had children protecting it. He had trained beasts to guard it. It wasn't far from the orphanage.
It's not far from here? Brenton asked.
It's quite far from here. This orphanage is not that one.
The old man's eyes fell into a dead, faraway gaze.
That one burned down.
Brenton said, Let me guess. That was the last you saw of Gally?
It was. It was.
Do you know what's there now? Sloane asked.
Nothing as far as I know. Just the valley, the hand, and the desolation that this world knows so well. But I know this. Now that Gally is back, he has returned to the Plaintive Hand. We've seen ships, and none may go that way, for that way is protected.
Protected by whom? She asked.
By Nima the Hunt.
They needed more information. At first she assumed who better to ask than the troopers and officers who now occupied this world. Together she and Brenton watched them and waited. But it soon became apparent that this was not the empire she knew and loved. These men and women were undisciplined. Their armor was filthy and in disrepair. Their weapons were crusted with the grit of this planet. Many troopers failed to wear their helmets. The officers looked ragged and run down. And yet they were paranoid. They were brutal, abusing villagers, stealing food and water, lording over the small towns like emboldened bullies. Worst and most important, they were believers in what Rax had done here. They carried his banners. They gathered around and told stories of the man. They have to buy all the way in. Brenton said. This isn't a military anymore. It's a militia. Any sign of doubt will be beaten out of them, I wager. And such bold bravado is the only way to justify following the Empire to this place.
Easier to lie to yourself that this is what's best than admit you've become part of something terrible? She asked.
Maybe.
Then we need an unbeliever.
She described the unbeliever simply. Someone who did not want to be here on Jakku. Someone who was swept along and was now caught in the machine and unable to climb out. Someone who was a loyal soldier, but not a sycophant. Brenton, with his technical skills, helped Sloan rig up a crude listening device. With it, they were able to capture bits of radio transmissions and conversations between Imperials. Then one day, they heard a trooper, ID number RK-242, telling his superior officer, a sergeant named Rylon, that he wasn't sure what they were doing here anymore, and he wondered if there was any other work anywhere in the galaxy he could be doing.
"I just don't want to be here anymore,"
RK-242 told Rylon. For that transgression, his fellow troopers, led by Rylon, dragged him out into the desert, stripped off his armor, and beat him bloody. Pieces of his armor littered the ground around him like the fragments of a broken shell, and RK-242 curled up among them in a fetal ball. "That is not Imperial justice," she thought. "No honor in that. Just brute force behavior. How swiftly order begins to disintegrate." They did not kill RK-242. He remained alive, if broken. Days later, he was back on duty, limping around, his armor clicking and clattering as he trembled inside it. Sloan went to him, had a little talk at the end of a blaster. RK-242 was thankful to see her. The moment she introduced herself, he began blubbering gratitude, snot bubbling at his nose, saliva stringing together his blistered split lips. Sloan explained to him that this was all a plot against her. Whether that was true or not, it mattered little. She said that Rax had committed a coup and had stolen the Empire from her grip. "He's going to destroy us all," she said. RK-242, through gulps and sobs, agreed. And then she pumped him for information. Everything she could. "What is in the valley? What is by the plaintive hand? What is Rax up to?" The trooper told her everything he knew. Rax called this world a place of purification. The unforgiving planet of Jakku would test them, train them, and harden them to stone. The only way to defeat the New Republic, Rax said, was to be transformed into a greater force, a cruel army, an empire that could survive the unsurvivable. That, and RK-242, referred to the man now as Counselor Rax. Seems her target had taken a new title for himself. How coy. She explained to RK-242 that the only recourse was to remove Rax from power. Violently, if need be. The trooper nodded gamely. Sloan said she needed to know everything about Rax, about his habits, his role here, anything. But RK-242 couldn't tell her much. He said the Empire had established a base beyond the Goazon, beyond the sinking fields. And it was there that Rax was consolidating his power. Every day, the Builder droids added more to the fortress, he said. And daily, too, came deliveries of TIE fighters, AT-ATs, AT-STs, troop carriers, new troopers. New ships arrived in the sky. The Empire gathered its assets, its resources, and its people. All here, on the planet or just above it. But that still told her nothing she didn't already know. She asked him again about the plaintive hand. He said that what he heard is that some old weapons facility lies hidden in the sand. Something built by Palpatine, or put here even earlier by, well, who knows? He heard Rax takes trips there, alone. And that's all RK-242 knew. He swore. He didn't even know if it was true, but he'd heard it. So can she help him? Can she rescue RK-242 from this purgatory? She ignored him and asked Brenton.
A weapons facility? Could that be why they're here on Jakku? Even still, that didn't add up. The Empire needed no new weapons. It built the greatest weapon in the history of the galaxy. Twice.
It did not need new battle stations. It needed new leadership. But the Empire did love its war machine. And maybe what's out there is something far greater than the Death Star ever was. A desire to find it and to kill Rax arose in her like hot magma churning up through the volcanic channel of her heart. Sloane thanked the trooper. She said she'd have an important role for him, and when the time came, she'd call on him. "Get back into your armor," she said. "Say nothing of this meeting to anyone." When he turned around to pick up his helmet, she shot him in the back of the head before he could put it on. Brenton cried out. He said, "We could have helped him." She answered, "There was no help for him." Then she said they had to go there, to whatever this facility was at the end of the Valley of the Eremite. One problem: they couldn't take a ship because they'd be shot down. And going on land meant going through the Yi'ulong canyons and beyond into the maze-like caverns of Bagheerlak Geiru. And that meant one thing: dealing with Nima the Hutt. Nima the Hutt owns this part of Jakku, and her slime trail stretches much farther than this territory. Like Jabba on Tatooine or Durga on Umatra, her influence and her corruption has a long tail. She runs the black market, slaves, scavenge, Kesium, Bezerite. She isn't just some fat slug ruler, though. She isn't Jabba with his palace or Durga with his yacht. It's not just gangster business as usual. Most Hutts love their parties and ceremonies. They make sure everyone kicks up a portion of their credits to the big boss that rules the region, whether as protection money or as tithe. No, Nima demands something bigger. Nima demands eternal service. It's not enough merely to work for her, no. One enters her stable of servants and never leaves. Though she treats herself as if she is a divine worm, born of sand and stone, those who serve her do so because she has set herself up in the middle of everything. A fat spider in the center of a web, a tumor drawing blood flow. She has the resources. She has the access. She controls who may move through the narrow canyons and deep caverns. Nima's power comes from what she controls. She controls resources, and so she controls people. Even still, Sloane wonders if over time those who follow her do so out of some kind of misguided worship. Because the rewards Jakku offers are so few and so meager, you either believe in something greater or die hopeless in the dust. Those who give their lives to her see nothing else for themselves. Serving Nima is literally the best option they have in a world of refuse and ruin. As Nima's long worm body writhes atop the hands of her servants, she speaks a command.
Humai, Diyama Diyanko.
Her voice is hard to take. It's as if someone swallowed broken glass and is trying to shriek through the subsequent throat full of blood. The way her gargled cry echoes through this chamber brings it back to Sloane's ears again and again. The sound of it forces a wave of nausea through her. Sloane knows some Huttese, but this phrase is in a more ancient dialect. It's more ragged, more primitive. Her statement means, what? Come to me? It must, because from underneath, one of her very literal supporters emerges. This one different from the others. A man, similarly shirtless and painted with red streaks of rock dust. His lips are the only part of him that aren't stuck with hooks. Everything else, his wrists, the pads of his palms, the flesh of his arms and of his legs, is pierced with metal. He carries something over his shoulder. From a leather strap hangs a black box and a dented, rusted speaker. A translator device. This servant climbs atop her, draping the translator over the meaty lump that passes for her shoulder. When placed, the box hangs down below her mouth. Then the slave waits, crouching upon the top of her head like a pet waiting the next command.
He looks like a hat,
Sloan thinks absurdly. Nima speaks again.
Manda!
The speaker crackles with static, and then a word emits from it in mechanical, monotone basic.
Speak!
Sloan clears her throat and remembers.
Be deferential.
Huts prefer to be spoken to as if they are not merely sentient, intelligent creatures. They like to be served. They want worship. This one more than others, it seems. Only problem is, Sloan doesn't do the deferential thing very well. Still, she clears her throat and makes a go of it.
Glorious serpent, mistress of sand and stone, Nima the Hunt. I am Grand Admiral Ray Sloan of the Empire. I come today to beseech your help. I and my traveling companion wish to pass through your cavernous territory and on toward the plateau called the Plaintive Hand.
The Hut interrupts her with a gabble of laughter.
Sayuka, Kumanavagavranyamriya.
The box translates.
Look at you. You are no Grand Admiral.
I assure you I am. And I will retake my empire. If you allow me to pass through, I will have much to offer you once I regain control.
But she already hears it in her own voice. She's bargaining from a place of weakness. Nima wants to be served, yes, and she wants to be the queen worm. But alternatively, if Sloane has to bow and scrape and act like a wriggling fly trapped on the fat beast's tongue, then she seems weak. Too weak to be taken seriously. She has to be humble while still seeming powerful. This is not something she knows how to do. How to perform as such a living contradiction. How does that even work? Answer, it doesn't. Again, the Hut bellows with laughter. She roars in her gargle shriek tongue, and the speaker returns a translation.
You will retake nothing. You have nothing to offer me.
To her servants, the Hut screams,
Take them, strip them, shear them, have their minds broken.
No, no, no.
It wasn't supposed to go like this. The slaves underneath Nima gently ease her to the stone, and one by one they come for Sloan and Brenton. He flashes her a frightened look, his hands forming into fists. But Sloan gives him a gentle head shake and mouths four words.
I can fix this.
Wait, she says, holding up both hands. The Hut slaves do not stop coming, but they slow down, creeping toward her on the balls of their feet, teeth bared, air hissing between them.
Gallius Rax is a pretender to the throne, and he is weak. I will be emperor.
Nima squawks. And the translator box barks.
Lie!
Hold!
The slaves stop. They freeze in place, as if automatons. They don't even blink. Nima's voice lowers, almost as if she's confiding in Sloan. Though the translator box knows no such inflection. When it decodes the response in basic, it does so in the same mechanized monotone.
I already have a deal with Counselor Rax. You are too late, Grand Admiral.
A deal with Rax? Of course she has a deal. He has to get through her territory somehow. He's given her something, or offered something. Sloan just has to find out what. Once more, the slaves surge toward her, grabbing at her wrists, her jaw, her throat. There's the flash of a blade, and she thinks, "Don't fight. Wait it out. Keep talking. Keep digging." Then, something turns inside her. She's been on this forsaken planet for months now. She's tired, raw-boned, and in pain. She is an admiral in the Imperial Navy, and the only one deserving of ruling the Empire. "I will not be abused anymore. Forget bargaining from weakness. It's time to try the other way. It is time to remember the strength of a Grand Admiral." Sloan roars and throws a punch. Her knuckles connect with the trachea of one of Nima's hut slaves, and he staggers back, clutching at his throat and keening in a high-pitched whine. All her NCB pugilistic training comes back to her, and she adopts a strong stance with one foot behind her and starts swinging as if each punch has to save her life. And she fears that each punch has to do exactly that. Her fists connect, a jaw snaps, a tooth scatters. A slave grabs a hank of her hair and she traps his arm, twisting it so hard she feels the bone break. The freak screams and drops, writhing like a spider set aflame. They keep coming. She keeps ducking, moving, punching. But she's getting fatigued. Pain throbs at her middle, radiating out like the ripples after a heavy rock hits calm water. The hut screams, and the box translates.
"Stop!"
Sloan sees Brenton. He is against the ground, his arms bent painfully behind him. Blood pools beneath his busted nose. Sloan thinks, "Forget him. Let him go. He has served his purpose." And yet, a part of her doesn't want to. Loyalty has to count for something. And Sloan doesn't want to be alone. Not yet. Not here. So she waits. She holds up her hands. And it's good that she does, because more of the hut's servants are crawling down out of the tunnels. Dozens of them now. A few of them with blasters, many with knives and clubs, all their weapons bound with tendon and bone. "I can't fight them all. I just can't." "What has Rax offered you?" she asks the hut. The hut gargles a reply. The box translates.
"We perform work for him. He provides us with weapons, equipment, supplies, whatever I ask."
Work? What work is the hut doing for Rax? That means her role goes beyond merely allowing him passage. Suddenly it dawns on her. What Anchorite Kolob said about children being stolen. What if the hut's people are doing the abducting? The Empire needs children. The slave boys advance upon her, slowly, step by step. Their blades swish at the air, their blasters thrust and point.
"Children," she says. "You bring him children."
The hut says nothing, but that silence is telling.
"Did Rax tell you where he's going?"
Sloan asks.
"Did he tell you what he's doing out there beyond your canyons?"
One word response.
"Yeah."
"No."
The hut's face betrays the monotone of the translator box. The slug's eye, the one ringed by glittering metal embedded in the flesh, opens wider.
A sign of curiosity, Sloan thinks.
Good. She presses the advantage.
"Don't you want to know?"
"Yeah, yeah.
Tell me."
And yet, Sloan hesitates to say more. If she gives this up, she's giving up more than information. What waits out there on the sand is perhaps useful not just to her, but to the whole Empire. The troopers said it was a weapons facility. Sloan dismissed that idea at first, but maybe there really is something there. Rax is no fool. If he wants it, she wants it too. The slaves continue creeping toward her.
They're going to kill me, or turn me into one of them.
She flashes on that. Her and Brenton, bleached white, painted with blood-red dust, kissing the rotten flesh of this wretched slime snake, their mistress. She tries to imagine the empire that she will one day rule, and the image of it, once strong in her head, is now a fading picture, like a painting under floodwater, its colors running, bleaching to the point of oblivion. It's ruined. It's over. There is no empire.
I'll never be the emperor of anything. The Hutt is right. I'm no grand admiral. I have my revenge, and only that.
That decides it. She hurriedly tells the Hutt,
"What's out there is a weapon. You let me go. You let me get Rax, and you can have it."
The Hutt dismisses it with a wave of her long-fingered hand, and the slaves advance. Brenton cries out as they smash his face harder into the stone. Sloane feels her blood pulsing in her neck, like a bird trapped in a tightening grip.
She keeps talking. "The weapon out there is bigger than any Death Star we've ever built. Imagine it. Imagine it being not in our hands, and not in the hands of the New Republic, but in the hands of the Hutts. Your hands. It is a weapon built for a god. Or a goddess."
It's a deception. She has no idea what the weapon is, or if it's a weapon at all. But if the lie gets her passage, lets her survive... Nima's hand goes up, quivering fingers splayed out. The Hutt slaves cease their advance. The words echo louder when the box translates them.
"We have a deal, Grand Admiral. You may pass. You will take me to the weapons facility."
"Take you? No, I must go alone."
But the Hutt is already turning around, slithering back toward the tunnels. Her slaves are again struggling to get underneath her, and when they do, they lift her up back toward the nearest chamber. As she slithers forward, the Hutt says, translated,
"Come, Grand Admiral. My temple awaits. First we feast, then at dawn we leave."